is the life of the party. He's the loudest dog I have. He's peeing on me. He's the most excitable dog, but he loves to go.
Hello and welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about a nice, healthy Iditarod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get too sick with it, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod 2020 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. It's Thursday, and it seems like it's the top concern for most folks right now. We have some coronavirus news. Yes, the Iditarod is no exception. In Nome, that's where the Iditarod finishes, of course, under the famed Burled Arch. The city council today is considering calling off all of the public events related to the Iditarod and I guess anything else where there might be mass gatherings of people. There are a number of festivities and a huge influx of visitors up there to Nome for the finish. And of course, that would dramatically reduce the fanfare at the finish. There are hundreds of people lining the finish chute no matter what time of day or night the first musher comes in. It's just raucous, and I just can't imagine what that's going to sound like without any fans there. We're also hearing about a big announcement coming from the Iditarod itself. Not sure what that's going to be, likely going to happen after our deadline for the podcast, but we've been told by someone close to the race that they are not going to be canceling the Iditarod altogether. I'm not sure how they would even do that with all the mushers and all the race officials and volunteers and veterinarians and everybody else out there on the trail, but at least they're telling us that it's not going to be a cancellation of the Iditarod at this point. And as disappointing as the news is that it sounds like Nome is likely going to be canceling all public events, at this point, none of it is a surprise. Since the pod dropped yesterday, the World Health Organization has declared coronavirus a global pandemic. Various governments are calling for bans on public gatherings. And among other sporting events affected, the NCAA says its college basketball tournament will be held without fans, and the NBA has canceled the rest of its season. And some more health news, if you can believe that. I'm going to welcome back Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon, our oil, gas, schools, and health correspondent, also working on the Iditarod. We have an update on Jeff King. If you remember, Jeff King had to bow out of this year's race just a few days before it. It would have been his 30th Iditarod. He had emergency surgery due to a perforation in his intestines. Tegan, what's the update?
Hey, Casey. Yeah, so we got a message from Jeff this morning saying he wanted to share some good news, and he says he'll be getting out of the hospital soon.
Yeah, and he's been in since last Monday night, since right after our live event that he was on stage with us for. Today, we're recording this, it's Thursday, so he's been in the hospital for over a week.
And he lives up near Denali National Park, so he's several hours from home. And it sounds like he's expecting to have to stay here in Anchorage in the city for the next few days as, you know, some treatment and follow-up continue.
Obviously a sign that he's doing better. Everyone's happy to hear that. He is getting close to getting out of the hospital. So we got that message in a text today. What else did they say?
Well, we also saw, I think it was yesterday, a Facebook post from Jeff King showing maybe just how good he's feeling in the hospital, or at least better. I think it's a public post, so if anyone wants to see it, go click on over to Jeff King's Facebook page. It kind of reminds me of the video of, like, the Singing in the Rain song, except instead of an umbrella, Jeff is holding, like, an IV pole, and he's dressed in a hospital gown, and he is skipping down the hospital hallways, running, spinning in circles. It's set to music.
Yeah, and it is a public post, and I've got it right here. Let's take a listen.
You can picture the skipping down the hospital hallways, the spinning with the IV pole.
That gives any indication of how Jeff King is feeling right now, that music. And like, yeah, the IV pole is like that thing that you see in TV shows or movies where the IV bags are hanging from this pole. It's got wheels on the bottom. And he's kind of, like you said, dancing his way down the hallway at the hospital. You forwarded this to me, and I thought at first it was just like some meme of someone getting out of a hospital. And when we looked a little closer, it was like, oh, yeah, that's Jeff King. He's stoked. He's getting out of there.
Yeah. And journalism for you. I was like, well, we can't talk about it on the podcast if it's not Jeff King. So I texted someone who works at his kennel to confirm. And she said, oh, yeah, that's him. Sense of humor intact.
Sense of humor intact. Intestines hopefully intact. He's a tough guy. And it's pretty lucky that they caught that before he went out on the race, because he's so tough, he probably would have just gone for it. He might have had some what Jeff would consider minor discomfort, and this could have been a real serious emergency. Definitely was life-threatening just even being here in Anchorage, but certainly out on the trail when you're far from rescue, you know, I don't even want to imagine what that would have been like. So anyway,
that's the Jeff King update.
That's the Jeff King update. All right. Well, Tegan, thank you again for being here with that. And we will let you get back to the many other jobs that you have to do today.
Thanks, Casey.
Okay, that's enough health news. The Iditarod continues at a healthy clip. After all, a lot of those dog mushers have been self-isolating and social distancing since long before this outbreak began. The big race news this morning is that Brent Sass was the first to the Iditarod's official halfway checkpoint of Cripple, arriving about 10 Wednesday night to claim the Dorothy G. Page Award and $3,000 in gold nuggets. That's from the telecommunications company GCI, and he also apparently had the option of, instead of the gold nuggets, taking a brand new Samsung Galaxy S20 cell phone with a free year of service. I'm guessing that he took the gold nuggets. Unclear at this point. Anyway, here's Brent Sass and the Wild and Free mushing team arriving in Cripple.
How's it going? Yeah. Man, it's warm out, huh?
That audio courtesy of Iditarod.com. The lead might not hold for long, however. As of this recording, Sass has yet to complete his 24-hour layover, along with Michelle Phillips, Lance Mackey, Paige Strobney, Mitch Seavey, Kelly Maxner, and Ali Zirkel, all of whom arrived behind him in Cripple. And that requirement is done for veteran mushers Jesse Royer, Richie Deal, Thomas Warner, and Aaron Burmeister, among many others who finished their 24s early this morning in Takotna. They comprised, like, that second chase pack, I guess you could call it, that as I'm recording this is on its way now from Ophir to Cripple. And according to dog musher Sebastian Schnule, riding for Iditarod Insider, 8 out of 10 teams historically have won the Iditarod after taking their 24-hour mandatory rest at Takotna. I have to admit, I have not gone back over every race to fact-check that, but Sebastian, who had a string of top 10 Iditarod finishes from 2008 to 2011, knows the Iditarod well and has been writing about it in detail for the Insider for years now. As far as who ends up out in front of the Iditarod, for real, we'll know more by tomorrow, after those chasers will likely pass the teams currently up front, who we can only assume will be taking their 24s and then giving chase themselves. It feels funny to say this halfway into the 1,000-mile Iditarod, but this is really where the race to Nome becomes clearer. And of course, there are the mushers who decided to take their 24s at Ophir. It's a little more rugged than Takotna, maybe not as rugged as Cripple, which is just kind of like some tents set up there. But Ophir is essentially a one-room cabin with a few small outbuildings and tents. The cabin was built in the 1930s by a miner back when Ophir was a small mining town in the midst of the region's short-lived gold rush. Compared to McGrath, Takotna, or Nikolai, there aren't a lot of conveniences to rely on. But for musher Travis Beals, who declared his 24-hour rest there, that is a worthwhile trade-off for the calm.
There's little interruptions, and you're in Takotna, everyone's on different feeding schedules and different migrating schedules from their bunk to their dog team, so that definitely doesn't really disturb the dogs, but it gets them out of their deep sleep. And what you want on your 24 is deep sleep, so they're definitely getting that. Yeah, it's like I got my own little lodge in there. I'm not fighting for space to dry stuff. You're not worried about your stuff, you know, wandering off. And you go to grab your boots, and you thought where you put them they would have been dry, and you know, you're about to leave your 24 and you found out they got moved, and so now they're soaking wet and There ain't none of that going on here, so.
Though he decided to spend his 24 there, Beals was not the only musher at Ophir on Wednesday afternoon. Allie Zirkel stopped there for a few hours, but like I said earlier, was set on making it up to Cripple. In Ophir, though, she was already exhausted, and she was resigned to the fact that in spite of her ambitions, the team is not on track to make it to Nome in first place.
Am I keeping the pace I wanted when I originally started this race and trying to win? No. No, this team does not have that pace. They didn't have the pace from the beginning. I don't really know what's going on with them. We are not on a competitive race right now. We are on a, let's get on down the trail efficiently, but my team is quite slow.
Allie Zirkel, a perennial top 10 finisher with second place finishes in 2012, 2013, and 2014. She finished in fourth place last year, not expecting to be up at the front when, hopefully, she finishes in Nome. So those last few pieces of tape were from Ophir, and sticking with Ophir, for the volunteers who run Iditarod checkpoints, there can be long stretches of downtime in between mushers arriving and departing, even with all of those chores that have to get done. Those are golden opportunities to catch some rest or chit-chat by the wood stove. And for Rick Cornejo, who's been helping his friends run the Spartan Ophir checkpoint out of a little cabin with just a few small outbuildings, it's a chance to tinker. He showed our reporter out on the trail, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes, a vintage 1950s chainsaw he found in a wood shop. And for 2 years now, Cornejo has been gradually bringing that chainsaw back to life.
This thing hasn't ran for 40 years, or that they know of. So, and it had old gas in it, so I tore it all apart last year and cleaned the carburetor out and tore it all apart, and it turns. Life is good.
And why?
But I couldn't get any sparks, so I took these home from last year, and a friend of mine and I in Palmer found a set of points that would work, and I put it together. This is actually the precursor for Craftsman. It was actually made for Sears and Simmons, or Simmons Sears in Canada.
Looks really heavy. You just found this out here, and you said...
Yeah, and then just decided that that's what I do. I like taking, resurrecting things from the dead. And I'm just always tinkering with stuff. So. Yeah, so that's what we do. They come out here every summer and go fishing in the creek. They come out and go moose hunting every fall.
And will this run? I mean, will it actually chop wood, or are you just trying to get it to look nice?
No, that's just going to be functional. You know, and then when I get it running, then I'll make it look nice. There's no sense in making it look nice when it's dead.
Museum piece.
Yeah, exactly.
Will it stay out here, or are you going to bring it back to
It'll stay out here. No, it'll live its life out here. Nobody will probably ever use it. I'm just doing it for a lot, to occupy time.
Do you restore other stuff?
I restore all kinds of stuff. I'm constantly buying stuff or getting stuff from the dumps and making things. And
what's the weirdest thing you ever hauled back from the dump that you found and restored?
Actually, I found a whole bunch of surplus aluminum I-beam that I turned into a big flatbed trailer. And when I was at the dumps, I found a whole bunch. It was a stage handrail, the 1.5-inch square tubing handrail. I've built all kinds of stuff out of that. The bleacher seats from the Palmer ice rink are now the deck for one of those trailers. The bleacher seats from the Wasilla football fields, or I've built flower pots and all kinds of stuff out of all that, so I'm constantly finding stuff and rebuilding it.
Is it just like the challenge, or to keep yourself occupied, or do you get some satisfaction from taking something that was cast off and kind of giving it a new life?
Yeah, exactly, that's what I do. Yeah, repurpose, reuse, renew, reinvent, whatever.
One thing we're not trying to reinvent here on the Iditapod are our listener questions. I mean, you know, different questions, same format. You can send your questions about the Iditarod or just dog mushing in general to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. The best way to do that is to record a voice memo of yourself, or heck, even a video, asking that question. Tell us who and where you are. And again, send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. We are loving getting those questions. Thank you all for having sent those. Okay, I guess that means it's time for today's listener question.
Hi, Iditapod. This is Kim calling from Milford, Michigan. I know that the teams running the Iditarod are experienced and genetically optimal animals, but they also have to learn to work as canine and human teammates. How important is dog training, and who's the best dog whisperer on the trail?
Hi, Kim. This is Zach. Great question about dog training and dog whispering. I'm sure a lot of different mushers would have a lot of different answers, and so let me try and give a hybrid one. Dog training is really important. Getting dogs to behave as a team instead of just sort of selfish individuals is definitely part of the training that they undergo. And mushers who have dogs who maybe are good pullers but give up partway through or don't like other teammates or are kind of independent, they're maybe not going to make the cut or not be part of the team. The dogs have to work together, they have to be okay with each other, they have to be dependable and reliable, and a lot of that happens in training where they learn to work together as a team. Who's the best dog whisperer on the trail? That's something every musher wants to be. A big part of being a skilled dog musher is being in a kind of simpatico relationship with your animals. And, you know, who is the best about getting them to follow commands, or the best at reading them, or the best at intuiting what they want? That's something I think everybody's working at. Who's the best is a question that somebody way more expert than me would have to answer. I will say, your Lifeseth Olsom whispers to his dogs quite a bit. I can't tell if it's in a language that I don't speak and don't understand, or if it's just sort of like baby gibberish. It's very cute, and you can hear him do it sometimes at checkpoints. So he is the most adorable dog whisperer that I've ever seen, but who's the best, I just don't know. Thanks for your question.
Yep, it's a fact. Your Olsom's dog gibberish, or whatever that is very cute. Like all the mushers out there, he's spent so much time with those dogs, they're really all just a team together with deep, deep connections. And more about the dogs, it's time for today's dog profile. It's Juke, like jukebox. Juke is a 2-year-old male in Karin Hendrickson's team, roughly 70 pounds, so a pretty big boy. And his main thing is that he looks sort of like lightish orange or tan. That's like his main color all over his whole body, maybe a little lighter on his belly. Some sort of darker markings on his face, but for the most part, he's just a real light sort of orange tan-colored dog. Karin talked about Juke with our reporter Tegan Hanlon with Alaska Public Media at the ceremonial start of the Iditarod in downtown Anchorage. Here's Karin.
So this is Juke, and he's 2, and he is the life of the party. He's the loudest dog I have. He's peeing on me. He's the most excitable dog, but he loves to go. And he comes from this long line of dogs I have where their father is all a dog named Fly. And he's definitely a Fly puppy, just happy all the time, full of energy all the time, never seems to get tired. So he makes it fun.
What does he think about his teammates and the other dogs in the yard?
Oh, he's a 2-year-old male, so he thinks he's the toughest dog around. And I have to keep reminding him that I'm the toughest dog around.
And spell his name for me. Is it J-U-K?
It's J-U-K-E. He's from a 2-puppy litter, Juke and Jive.
Okay, and he's 2 years old. What is his position on the team?
He's actually stepping up to do quite a bit of leading, so we'll see how he feels farther into the race. But he's very strong just as far as being an engine in the team, but he shows a lot of talent in lead, so we'll see if he steps it up.
At last check, Karin Hendrickson had 13 dogs in her team, so she has dropped one along the way. It is unclear which dog that is, at least to me, so we'll wait to see if Juke really did step it up for her. Well, we're stepping up and stepping out. That's about all the time we have for today. Stay rested, my friends. Wash your hands. Don't stay up too late watching the Iditarod tracker. But definitely keep your spirits up. If that helps, do what you gotta do. If you're an Iditarod lover, I'm guessing this is a welcome distraction from all of the other news, health-related and otherwise, going on out there. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
It charges with a USB cord right here, and are you ready for its noise? It's like a little taser. Isn't that awesome?
It looks like a taser where
it works great.
Shoots across the way.
Yeah, it's 100%. It's supposed to light 80-mile-an-hour winds, too.
Don't want to find out.
No, I don't want to find out.
How easy is it to charge via USB?
I've never charged it yet, but you get 300 strikes out of one full charge, so I don't think I'm going to do that unless I keep showing people because I'm so excited about it.
Congratulations, Christy.